Well, first of all, let me just say you can tell who the truly spiritual people in this life are. They're the ones that show up on Christmas Sunday morning when we've already had a service the night before. Also, just so you know, we made special arrangements and worked out it out so that the Bears game would be played yesterday, because we knew that today, of course, the service was going to be a little bit later. So see how we've worked all this out for you? Isn't that just wonderful? Anyway, thanks much for coming out again on this Christmas Day, and especially for the faithful that have done so. One of the reasons that we're doing this, I lobbied for it personally, that we would have a service today. And of course, if I was a kid, I would have lobbied against it, just so you know. But the reason is, some of you may know who Kevin DeYoung is. So the people who work at Crossway Publishing know who he is, because they published a couple of his books. But Kevin wrote an article that was making an appeal to churches to go ahead and have services on the Lord's Day. Family is important. We're deep believers in family. But family isn't the biggest priority in the world for us, but it is a priority. But worshiping God is a big priority. And so he was making the case and appealing to churches to go ahead and have Christmas Day services. And then, of course, Lifeway Research, that kind of makes their business to go out and find out, you know, what are the trends out there? They found that a significant majority of churches are also having Sunday services, Christmas Day services, if you will. And so we just decided to go ahead and do that. Now, I realize that we might very possibly not have our normal Sunday audience. And therefore, asking a pastor to leave his family from some other church and to come in and to speak this morning, we didn't feel was appropriate, and thus I volunteered. But I just say that as a way of introduction. Again, thank you for showing up. We have, over the course of the last few weeks, talked about a few of the interesting and unusual things about Christmas, the facts that come along that, you know, we absorb during this time of year. And I was going to share a few more of those this morning. First of all, how many of you have ever received a Christmas card with robins on it? Anybody got Christmas card with robins? Really? Oh, actually, I have received a Christmas card. Well, we have, yeah, a couple people have. Robins on cards were actually a joke 150 years ago when postmen wore red tunics and were named after them. How about tangerines? Anybody get any tangerines this Christmas season? I know some people in this room did. Okay, well, why do we do that? That tradition in stockings comes from 12th century French nuns who left their socks full of fruit, nuts, and tangerines at the houses of the poor. We're not sure whether they were clean socks or not, but that's the way they did it back then. Carols weren't even sung in churches until they were introduced by St. Francis of Assisi back in the 13th century. Stockings. Well, hanging stockings comes from a Dutch custom of leaving shoes packed with food for St. Nicholas's donkeys, and he would leave small gifts in return. The tallest tree, the world's tallest Christmas tree that has ever been put up, you want to take a guess in your mind how tall it is, that tree was 221 feet tall. Now, you think about that. That's almost like 20 stories tall of a Christmas tree. And that was in a Washington shopping mall back in 1950. In 1990, residents of the state of Maine built the world's biggest ever snowman. 113 feet tall. Think about putting a hat on that baby, would you, just for a moment? How about eating a Christmas tree? Is there anybody here who's ever eaten their Christmas tree or part of their Christmas tree? Okay. Well, actually, many parts of the Christmas tree apparently can be eaten, with the needles being a good source of vitamin C. However, there is no indication that eating artificial trees offer the same kind of nutrient, just so you know. Holly in the wreath has a symbolism attached to it. It symbolizes Christ's crown of thorns, while the red berries symbolize his drops of blood. Jingle Bells was the very first song broadcast from space when Gemini 6 astronauts Tom Stafford and Wally Schirra sang it in December of 1965. Best-selling Christmas single ever. What would it be? White Christmas. And they've sold over 50 million copies of that song worldwide since 1942. And by the way, there are such things available to purchase as upside-down artificial Christmas trees. There are. And do you know why they do that? So there's more room under the tree for presence. That's why they do it. It's a true thing. Electric tree lights were invented by Edward Johnson in 1882. You may remember I mentioned before how when Martin Luther started it out, they put these candles on trees. And so the electric lit trees became more popular. A Christmas movie, the highest grossing Christmas movie in the 2000s. Elf, Home Alone, what else? How the Grinch Stole Christmas. Now that's how you learn the message of Christmas right there, ladies and gentlemen. How about gold coins? Anybody get any of those gold coins in there? Not real ones, but sometimes you get them. I saw them at Target the other day. You can buy them and put them in stockings and such like that. That actually commemorates St. Nicholas, who gave bags of gold coins to the poor. The real St. Nicholas, by the way. And finally, in Greece, Italy, Spain, and Germany, I know you'll be excited about this, workers get a Christmas bonus of 1 month's salary by law. Anybody want to move with me? We'll just, all right. Well, at our house, we have our own Christmas traditions, by the way. And last night, after we came to the candlelight service, we did one of those. We went home and I made Swedish pancakes. And we'd picked up some Swedish potato sausage. We do this every year, and that's part of our Christmas tradition. And then, you know, we do the Christmas breakfast this morning at our daughter's house. We did that. We have sausage bake. This makes, you know, no real sense. We have Swedish potato sausage the night before, and then we have sausage bake the next day. So, but it's a wonderful way to celebrate the Christmas season. And, of course, a lot of people do what we like to do generally during the Christmas season, and that's watch movies. Do you have a favorite Christmas movie, by the way? Was Elf one of them? Oh, It's a Wonderful Life. Yeah, terrific Christmas movie. Anything else? Favorites? Do you watch year to year? Christmas Story. Huh? No, none others? Okay, well, Rhonda, nobody hit ours. The Muppets Christmas Carol. Yeah. Well, you know, Charles Dickens published his novella of the book of this back in 1843, basically just in time for the holiday shopping rush. And they reported even back then it became an instant bestseller. That, by the way, that book has been turned into film, get this, 200 times. With actors varied such as George C. Scott, Bill Murray, Patrick Stewart, Scrooge McDuck, and Michael Caine, of course, playing the leading role in The Muppets Christmas Carol. And we like that. And, of course, I think it's one of our favorites because you got Kermit the Frog as Bob Cratchit. He should have won an Academy Award for that, in my opinion. But and, again, Miss Piggy, Emily Cratchit. And then I personally like Rizzo the Rat, and then also the little mice, which in that movie, by the way, are often referred to as Mises. You know, while that movie can stir a lot of emotions, it's really quite interesting because the background of that book, why he wrote it and what that production is about, has a much bigger cause than simply what the movie might portray to us. Published again back in that 1843 time period, it was during a time where there were very harsh labor practices, child labor practices. And that Christmas Carol carried poignance in the original context that it's still difficult for us to fully grasp today. The severity of living conditions back in 19th century London, combined with the ambivalence of its, what we'd say, paternalistic legal courts, illustrated in other of Dickens' writings, like Bleak House, is really too hard to exaggerate. The disparity in the standard of living between the top income earners of London's population and the bulk of its citizens was rather stark. And for the tiny Tims of those times, conditions really could be remarkably miserable. Here's the way it's described in Christianity Today's history column. Children growing up in London during the Hungry 40s, a depression coupled with poor harvest, were steeped in these disparities. The skyline was a sea of profitable smokestacks, puffing clouds of sooty grit that covered rooftops and the cheeks of young chimney sweeps. Coal was the energy source du jour, and the resulting London fog often hid the real picture. The streets were covered in rainwater, the contents of chamber pots and animal waste. Rats abounded. Now you can see where Rizzo the rat might have fit in well in that. Small, often emaciated children sold flowers and matches while the wealthy class's horse-drawn carriages swept past. Yes, ladies and gentlemen, grime and grit were found everywhere. And those too poor to afford transportation simply had to walk around in it. Despite the horrid conditions, the birth rate rose as mortality rates fell. More children now lived than died, and as the population grew, so did the price of food. Those are the conditions in which Charles Dickens was trying to speak to a culture that he was troubled by. He had a heart for action, and his life portrays a reformer definitely with a conscience. In fact, it's recorded that he set up a house for rescuing, reforming, and educating prostitutes back in 1845. For many social issues of the day, government provided little relief, and they say that the church really did little as well to make a difference in the lives of these people. So one can see why that clarion call to many uncaring elites would capture Dickens' writing imagination. And what better name to attach to a penny-pinching, self-interested miser than Ebenezer Scrooge? Who could not feel the tension in the absence of helping a family with a poor, crippled boy like Tim Cratchit? It should be noted that Tiny Tim was just one again of many of these seemingly innocent, angelic, victimized children who had grim futures. The stirring message conveyed that we get from A Christmas Carol probably has touched you in some way, perhaps as we've pondered ourselves the ghosts of Christmas past and present and future, and we've been caught up in the idea of, wow, what has my life? How do others see my life? What has it been like if I go back and could look through the window of the way my life has been? But at the end of that story, of course, we also find a redeemed man, a changed Ebenezer Scrooge, if you will, who seeks to reconcile with his life's past injustice. Charles Dickens proved himself to be a man concerned again about injustice. You know, I selected that to just mention today because that word, injustice, seems to characterize a lot of the discussions in which we find ourselves in today. And we look for solutions from government. We hear about genocide in various places of the world. We hear about terrorism. We read about it all the time and the injustices done to people, especially in places like Aleppo that we've read about within the last few weeks. Slavery. And then, of course, let's just talk about the income inequality. You know, we can all have our own views about what the best political system is, but as we all know, there are people who make very large sums of money up here, and there are very people who make very little sums of money down here. And what is the clarion cry often of people who protest? They want justice, or they want equality. They want something along the way. In other words, even though our situation is a whole lot better than those people who lived in the 18th century back in England, at the same time, we still find injustice in our world today. Two likely responses come out of this sense of people feeling that there are too many injustices, and they're facing them. One of them is hopelessness, and the other is helplessness. We often, again, look to government to try to bring solutions to that. And regardless of which political way you sat in the last election, or maybe didn't vote at all, let's face it, a lot of people were thinking, government is going to do something about my situation. One day, ladies and gentlemen, one day a government will come, and it will change. It will be different, and it will end all injustice. The biblical prophet Isaiah envisioned it, and with that, it becomes our scripture passage for today. Isaiah 9, verses 6 and 7, very familiar, especially for those of you who've heard the Messiah over and over again. For to us a child is born, to us a son is given. The government shall be upon his shoulder, and his name shall be called Wonderful Counselor, Mighty God, Everlasting Father, Prince of Peace. Of the increase of his government and of peace, there will be no end. On the throne of David and over his kingdom, to establish it and uphold it with justice and with righteousness, from this time forth and forevermore, the zeal of the Lord of hosts will do this. John MacArthur offers some really good insights on this particular passage. He writes, "Politics and government, necessary evils, bringing frustration in the present, but still giving some hope for the future. What man cannot do, God has done. He's given us a Messiah." Again, those verses, "For unto us that child is born, that son is given, Wonderful Counselor, Mighty God, Eternal Father, Prince of Peace. The government will rest upon his," and some translations, by the way, use the word shoulders. ESV translates it shoulder, just as in case you're wondering why there seems to be some disparity on that. Again, this passage may be one of the most familiar passages of Old Testament prophecy about the birth of Jesus. And though we still await the realization of the kingdom, the promised Messiah is the greatest political ruler ever. Isaiah looked across centuries to a time when God would rule the earth through his son. Notice that phrase again. A child will be born to us. It underscores the Messiah's humility. He had come as a human being in the form of a child. A son will be given to us, implies the Savior's deity. He existed before his birth as the second person of the Trinity. The government will rest on his shoulder, or shoulders again, and that affirms his lordship. This verse looks to a time in the future when Christ will reign over a literal, earthly, geopolitical kingdom. And in that day, the government of the whole world will rest on his shoulders. And until that time, we deal with an invisible kingdom. The Messiah's rule over those who trust him and obey him as Lord is the kingdom that we now live in. It is an invisible kingdom. At a time when the world is weary and despairing of political solutions, when the political future looks bleak to some, whether it's our country or around the world, this is welcome news. No confusion in the future. No confusion. He is a wonderful counselor. This kingdom is free from confusion because Christ is the kind of counselor that can reach and touch everyone. Jesus always knew during his time on earth what to say and when to reach out to a seeking heart. As God incarnate, Christ is the source of all truth. Many of our politicians turn everywhere else for counsel. Some might go to listen to their fellow politicians. Others go to psychologists or psychiatrists or analysts or philosophers or spiritual gurus of one kind or another. But the King of Kings keeps his own counsel. No chaos. He is the mighty God. The Messiah's kingdom is singularly free from chaos because he is the mighty God. He is the one in creation who brought order out of chaos. Chaos, in fact, is antithetical to who he is. He is a God of order. Christ, the King, is orderly. Legislation can only go so far. You know what it fails to do? It fails to change the human heart. Oh, you can force people for a while to obey, but you cannot change the inner part of man. But the mighty God can do things like that. When Jesus Christ comes to rule this earth, he'll display his divine power by bringing order to the chaos. Because Christ is God, he can forgive sin, defeat Satan, liberate people from the power of evil, redeem them, and answer their prayers. Also, no complexity. He is the Father of eternity. Now you think about that. No complexity in the Messiah. In comparison to human governments, the Messiah's kingdom is uncomplicated because he is the eternal Father. In this country, one of the chief things people tend to complain about, oh, I couldn't even get this thing done because of all the bureaucracy. Just the layers and the complications. When you think about the government of the future, that with Jesus, there is no bureaucracy. And if he wants things done, he gets things done. He is unique in that sense. It is simple and uncomplicated. Next, no conflicts. He is the Prince of Peace. Finally, in the Messiah's kingdom, there is no conflict because truly, he rules the world and will one day in true divine peace. And he offers it to all who are recipients of his grace. And not just a peace, by the way, that comes in the future where you have to wait eternally for it. But as we embrace him in the depths of our heart, he gives us an assurance that we can have peace on this earth about our future. That angelic of peace on earth was a two-pronged proclamation, again, not only for the future, but for this time as well. Who are those with whom he is pleased? As the scriptures say, as the angel said, they are those who have yielded their lives to the authority of government. How can anything perfect what has already been perfected by God? There will be no end to the increase of his government or of his peace. That is the way the Bible describes it. Despite the turbulence in our world, in our own country, on so many levels, Christmas reminds us that hope can exist even in the midst of injustice. And we have to look for those kind of voices. Gary Haugen, who's the CEO of International Justice Mission, says we can have hope in the God of justice, hope in the God of compassion, hope in the God of moral clarity, and hope in the God of rescue. This Jesus, who came as Isaiah predicted, asks us to invite him into the center of our lives. And the question is, are we willing to do that? You know, along with that voice of Charles Dickens in the mid-1800s, there was another very influential voice from that same part of the world in England. And he was a significant voice in the mid-1800s, and his name was Charles Spurgeon. Right about this time, he did a rather lengthy sermon that was titled, Have You Any Room? And while I'm not going to share the lengthy sermon, I do have a slight abbreviated version that I would like to share some of the notes from Charles Spurgeon. He said, when all persons of the house of David were sent on to Bethlehem, the scanty accommodation of the little town would soon be exhausted. Doubtless friends entertained their friends till their homes were all full, but Joseph had no such willing kinsmen in the town. There was the inn with the courtyard, which was provided, by the way, in every village. They had these inns and the courtyard in the middle, and that is where free accommodations were given to travelers. Yet this, too, you see, was full. And coming from a distance and compelled to travel slowly, the humble couple had arrived late in the day, and the rooms all taken, and the courtyard taken as well. There remained no better lodging, even for a woman in travail, than one of the inferior spaces appropriated to beasts of burden. The stall of the donkey was the only place where the child could be born. And maybe by hanging a curtain, that was the only place where the child could be born with a place of privacy, with a curtain at the front. Well, the needed seclusion maybe could be obtained in this fashion, maybe. But here in the stable was the King of Glory, born, and in this manner was he laid. What, could the palaces of emperors and the halls of kings afford the royal stranger no refuge? Alas, my brothers and sisters, seldom is there room for Christ in palaces. State chambers, cabinets, throne rooms, and royal palaces are about as little frequented by Christ as the jungles and swamps of India by the cautious traveler. He frequents small residences far more often than regal ones, for there is no room for Jesus in regal halls. Oh, but there were senators, right? There were forums of political discussion. There were the places where the representatives of the people make the laws. Was there no room for Christ there? Alas, my brothers and sisters, no room. And to this day, there is very little room for Christ in the halls of government. Parties, policies, place hunters, pleasure seekers exclude the representative of heaven from a place among representatives of earth. Oh, might there not be room found for Christ in what is called good society? You know, those places where the rich people live. Were there not in Bethlehem some people that were very respectable who kept themselves aloof from the common multitude, persons of reputation and such? Oh, dear friends, it is too much the case that there is no room for him in what is called high society. Folly and finery, rank and honor, jewels and glitter, frivolity and fashion, all report that there is no room for Christ in their abode. But is there not room for him on the financial exchanges? Ah, could he not be taken to the marts of commerce? Here are the shopkeepers of a true money-making enterprise. Is there not room for Christ here? Dear friends, how little of the spirit and life and doctrine of Christ can be found in this arena. Bankruptcies, swindlings, frauds are so abundant that in hosts of cases there is no room for Jesus in the malls or the shops. And then there are the schools of the philosophers. Surely they will entertain him. But no, dear friends, it is not so. Very little room for Christ in colleges and universities these days. Very little room for him in the seats of learning. Oh, a few with splendid talents, a few of the erudite and profound have bowed like children at the feet of the babe of Bethlehem and have been honored in bowing there. But too many, conscious of their knowledge, stiff and stern in their conceit of wisdom, they have said, "Who is Christ that we should acknowledge him?" But there's surely one place where he could go. Ah, the Sanhedrin, where the elders sit. Or could he not be housed in the very priestly chamber where the priests assemble? No, he found no shelter there either. No, it was there that instead he found some of his most ferocious enemies. There's no room for him where his name is chanted in solemn hymns and his image lifted up amidst smoke of incense. Go where you will, and there is no space for the Prince of Peace, but with the humble and contrite spirits, which by grace he prepares to yield him shelter. As the palace, the forum, the inns have no room for Christ, and as the places of public resort have none, now we come, as we say, to the payoff. Have you room for Christ? Well, says one person, I have room for Jesus, but I am not worthy that he should come to me. Ah, I did not ask about worthiness, but have you room? Oh, but I feel it is a place not at all fit for Christ. Well, nor was the manger a place fit for him, and yet that is where he was laid. Oh, but I have been such a sinner, I feel it in my heart that it's been a den of beasts and devils. The manger had been a place where beasts had fed. But have you room for him? Never mind what the past has been. He can forgive you and he can forget. It matters not what even the present state may be if you have steep regrets about it. If you have but room for Christ, he will come and be your guest. I pray that you do not say, I hope I shall have room for him. You see, the time is come for him to be born, and born in you as well. One said, I have room for him, but will he come? He will indeed, if your heart is open. My master wants room, and he wants to room with you. Do you have room for him? Here is the Son of God made flesh. He is the one who has come to seek you. This is all I ask, your emptiness, your nothingness, your want of feeling, your want of goodness, your want of grace. All of these are yours if you but make room for him. Have you such room? Spirit of God, lead many to say even this morning, yes, my heart is ready. Then he will come and he will dwell with you. As I close this morning, I am going to include something that years ago was recorded by one of the most well-known radio people of all time, Paul Harvey. And during a Christmas season way back as early as the 1960s, he put a piece together that is simply called The Man and the Birds. And I've always loved that piece. I played it on my years at Moody Radio as we approached Christmas Day every single year. And it is one of those pieces, ladies and gentlemen, that I believe for those people who can't quite grasp the message of Christmas, I think you will find it here. And so I would ask Pete if you will go ahead and we can start the music on this at this time. I would let you know that that very idea of another man from the 18th century, Charles Spurgeon, hit it very much on the head when he explained that that door that is open in the human heart, and that person who is willing to receive the message of good news, can find the real blessedness of this Christmas season, an open door and welcoming to the soul who waits for him. And with that, Merry Christmas.
Unable to trace its proper parentage, I have designated this as my Christmas story of the man and the birds. You know, the Christmas story, the God born a man in a manger and all that, escapes some moderns, mostly, I think, because they seek complex answers to their questions, and this one's so utterly simple. So for the cynics and the skeptics and the unconvinced, I submit a modern parable. Now, the man to whom I'm going to introduce you was not a Scrooge. He was a kind, decent, mostly good man, generous to his family, upright in his dealings with other men, but he just didn't believe all that incarnation stuff which the churches proclaim at Christmas time. It just didn't make sense, and he was too honest to pretend otherwise. He just couldn't swallow the Jesus story about God coming to earth as a man. "I'm truly sorry to distress you," he told his wife, "but I'm not going with you to church this Christmas Eve." He said he'd feel like a hypocrite, that he'd much rather just stay at home, but that he would wait up for them. And so he stayed, and they went to the midnight service. Shortly after the family drove away in the car, snow began to fall. He went to the window to watch the flurries getting heavier and heavier, and then went back to his fireside chair and began to read his newspaper. Minutes later, he was startled by a thudding sound. Then another. And then another, sort of a thump or a thud. At first, he thought someone must be throwing snowballs against his living room window. But when he went to the front door to investigate, he found a flock of birds huddled miserably in the snow. They'd been caught in the storm and, in a desperate search for shelter, had tried to fly through his large landscape window. Well, he couldn't let the poor creatures lie there and freeze, so he remembered the barn where his children stabled their pony. That would provide a warm shelter if he could direct the birds to it. Quickly, he put on a coat, galoshes, tramped through the deepening snow to the barn. He opened the doors wide and turned on a light. But the birds did not come in. He figured food would entice them in. So he hurried back to the house, fetched breadcrumbs, sprinkled them on the snow, making a trail to the yellow-lighted, wide-open doorway of the stable. But to his dismay, the birds ignored the breadcrumbs and continued to flop around helplessly in the snow. He tried catching them. He tried shooing them into the barn by walking around them, waving his arms. Instead, they scattered in every direction, except into the warm-lighted barn. And then he realized that they were afraid of him. To them, he reasoned, "I am a strange and terrifying creature. If only I could think of some way to let them know that they can trust me, that I'm not trying to hurt them, but to help them. But how? Because any move he made tended to frighten them, confuse them. They just would not follow. They would not be led or shooed because they feared him. If only I could be a bird," he thought to himself, "and mingle with them and speak their language. Then I could tell them not to be afraid. Then I could show them the way to the safe, warm..." "To the safe, warm barn, but I would have to be one of them so they could see and hear and understand." At that moment, the church bells began to ring. The sound reached his ears above the sounds of the wind, and he stood there listening to the bells, Adeste Fidelis, listening to the bells pealing the glad tidings of Christmas. And he sank to his knees in the snow.